From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Confessions of a Girl Gang, we talk with Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel, set in upstate New York in the 50s. A group of five high school girls forms Foxfire, a gang dedicated to taking revenge against men who sexually harass them. Also, in the company of homeless women, when Elliot Lebo learned he had cancer, he left his job and worked at a homeless shelter. His new book is about the women he met there. And Ken Tucker reviews Sons of Soul, the new release by Tony Tony Tony. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is preparing for a nationally broadcast address to drum up public support for the compromise budget plan that faces House and Senate approval this week. The president said that Republican opponents of the measure have been playing pure politics and confusing the public about how the bill's tax increases will be distributed. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole asserted that the measure contains the largest tax increase in the history of the world. Democrats dispute that, pointing to the 1982 Reagan administration tax hike that Dole supported. The Senate voted today to reject a measure that would have excluded coverage for abortions from the health plans of federal workers. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The issue of abortion rights came to the floor as the Senate was considering a spending bill for the Treasury Department and Postal Service. Oklahoma Republican Don Nichols proposed placing restrictions on abortion coverage in federal health insurance, but he was outmaneuvered when Maryland Democrat Barbara Mikulski argued that the restriction sought to deny women access to their legal and constitutional rights, and in any event was not germane to the appropriations bill. By a vote of 51-48, the Senate backed Mikulski, with some lawmakers weighing in on the pro-abortion side because they agreed that the Nichols amendment was not relevant. Mikulski declined to declare today's action a test case on how the Senate would vote in future debates on abortion. The issue is likely to come up again on other spending bills. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The presidents of Serbia, Montenegro, and Croatia have been called back to Geneva to try to revive negotiations to end the war in Bosnia. The leaders went straight into informal talks with the Bosnian president, Alija Izetbegovic, and the co-chairman of the peace conference. The talks have been stalled for 2 days. Kathy Jenkins reports from Geneva.
The political leaders and negotiators are holding late-night talks in a villa just outside Geneva. The powerful presidents of Serbia and Croatia have been called back to try to restart negotiations. They've floundered over the division of territory and the drawing up of maps. The Bosnian president, Ali Izetbegovic, has been boycotting the talks because of the continued Serbian offensive around Sarajevo, saying the carve-up of Bosnia is still being settled on the battlefield. But in central Bosnia, it's the Muslim forces which have been on the offensive. They've expelled Croatian troops and caused thousands of Croatian civilians to flee. The Muslim offensive has split the mixed Bosnian presidency, with the three Bosnian Croat delegates announcing they will not participate as long as what they call ethnic cleansing and genocide against Croats continues. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Jenkins in Geneva.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained a fraction of a point to close at 3,561. This is NPR News. A federal appeals court in Cincinnati has ruled that John Demjanjuk must be allowed to return to the United States while a court investigates his extradition to Israel. An Israeli court acquitted Demjanjuk of being a Nazi death camp guard known as Ivan the Terrible. He says he wants to return to the United States, but the Justice Department insists he lost his U.S. citizenship by lying about his Nazi past on his citizenship application. Terrorism researcher Yonah Alexander says 1993 could be the bloodiest year in terms of terrorism since 1970. The George Washington University professor says ethnic, racial, and religious intolerance are helping to fuel an upswing in terrorist activity. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Professor Alexander says U.S. involvement in trying to bring peace to the former Yugoslavia and the Middle East could trigger terrorist operations against this country. He says intelligence and law enforcement agencies should be on guard against both state-sponsored and independent terrorist acts.
We should expect escalation of terrorism in the United States, in my view, and around the world for specific reasons, such as retaliation for the arrest of Sheikh Omar Rahman, or revenge on the Israeli operation in Lebanon, the Operation Accountability.
Alexander says foreign groups don't provide the only terrorist threat. He says extremists in the anti-abortion movement and neo-Nazis are only a few of the domestic groups that should be carefully monitored. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
People in the small town of Prairie du Rocher, Illinois, are waiting to see whether a risky tactic will save their homes from the flooding Mississippi River. Officials deliberately breached a levee 3 miles upstream from the historic town. The hope is that the broken levee will draw off water that otherwise might spill over the levee. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joyce Carol Oates is an incredibly prolific writer, the author of 23 novels, as well as many short stories and essays. She's covered a lot of territory, from a reworking of the romance novel to a book about boxing. Her new novel, Foxfire, is about the members of a girl gang in a small upstate New York town in the 1950s. They take a blood oath and swear never to betray each other. They think of themselves as a true sisterhood, not just the girl version of crude boy gangs. The Foxfire gang finds its mission to take revenge against the men who sexually harass them. The story is told by the now 50-year-old woman who was a member of the gang and served as its chronicler. When Oates was growing up in upstate New York, she went to school with some tough girls. She stayed on the outside observing, but she could imagine the attraction of being in a gang.
Oh, it's very intense, and it has its romantic underpinnings, I think, in early adolescence, particularly for girls who are from broken homes or from impoverished neighborhoods. It's basically what we all want, a sense of some communal solidarity, a sense that somebody loves you, a sense of sisterhood. The friendships of young girls, I think, are perhaps the most intense of all friendships.
What do you think that is?
Because they're new. When we're 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, we're making friendships of a kind we've never made before. Everything is very fresh and new and very, very emotional. The rises and dips, the ups and downs of these relationships is extremely passionate.
The girls in the gang in your novel organize against men who try to fondle them. Men are the enemy. Why have you made men the enemy?
Well, it isn't men really in the beginning so much as a need that the girls feel for protection against those who have power. They themselves don't have power. It happens to be men who have power, teachers and older boys. It isn't so much that they're men, so much as that power resides with them. And when we're powerless, we need to band together with others to protect ourselves. I think the issue of sexuality comes a little later in the novel.
I think a lot of girls in their young teens get really obsessed with boys. How did you see that figuring into the girls in your novel?
Well, these girls are reacting against that. Obviously, all around them, they see other girls who are obsessed with boys, and they've had experiences with older sisters or, say, their mothers. We get the sense that Maddie's mother may have had very unhappy or even disastrous sexual relations with men. And Legs's mother obviously did. The marriage was very unhappy. So they're really reacting against that. But I wanted also, in the larger sense, to be critiquing the feminist idea of excluding men, because as the girls' gang evolves, as the years pass, and they become more and more fanatic, it becomes a sort of monomaniacal ideal to exclude men, and that brings about the end of the gang. It's not that I am myself a feminist, but I was really hoping to put that ideal to the test. That is, if you posit men as the enemy, then you're making a grave mistake, and eventually your idealism will crumble.
Mm-hmm. Well, you often write about teenage girls. Why are you so interested in that period of life?
Well, I write about people of all ages, actually. And I do write a good deal about adults, and I write about men.
Mm-hmm.
So I do...
Because you write enough, you could cover everybody.
Yeah, right. I'm just very interested in adolescence because I see it as such a passionate and a romantic time. I remember my own adolescence very well. When I go back to Lockport, New York, as I was just doing last week, and I walked around some of the same streets and saw the Erie Canal and the locks and some of the settings for Foxfire, actually, all these old emotions come sweeping back and sort of flooding into my heart, and I feel this sense of a childlike excitement at the prospect of life, even though, in fact, I'm extremely mature and I'm a professor at Princeton University. It's as if I'm transported back to some other time.
What were your passions, your obsessions, your fears when you were a young girl growing up in Lockport, in Millersport?
Well, I feel that I can't really talk that much about myself. I feel a little self-conscious. But Maddie, the narrator in my novel, and other characters in novels of mine, like You Must Remember This and Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, obviously overlap very much with my own experiences and many of my thoughts about life, my sentiments, my philosophy, and so forth. I put a good deal of myself in these characters. But there's a margin of my own self, naturally, since I am an adult, I am a professor, and I'm a writer, that margin of myself is not in the novels. That is, I'm writing about girls who are not myself.
Mm-hmm. Some of your novels and stories have to do with violence, and you know there's some violence in your new novel, and it seems to me that you yourself are somebody who is a person who probably lives more in her mind. Do you know what I mean? Than in a really big physical way. You don't strike me as somebody who would be violent.
No, I think most people are probably not violent until something happens. They may be put to the test.
Yet you're obviously really interested in people who are.
I wrote a book on boxing.
So right.
I saw
yes.
This is the quintessential masculine sport, which makes violence a kind of aesthetic activity.
Can you explain your interest in violence? Is it because of its dramatic quality, or is it something other than that?
Well, all writers write about violence. I think it's mainly the case that women writers have not characteristically written about it. Women have, through the centuries, women have tended to write about domestic events, or like Virginia Woolf, they write about a very rarefied kind of experience. So women have been typecast as not writing about certain subjects, but of course, as we all know, the sexes can do anything. I mean, men can write about childbirth and domestic life, and women can certainly write about war. There have been wonderful women journalists writing about Vietnam and women photographers taking photographs of wartime, like Margaret Burke White. So I think it's mainly that I'm asked questions about violence that Ernest Hemingway or Norman Mailer would not have been asked because they're men.
I'd ask them. Because I ask men who write about violence all the time and always ask them about it.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think they probably would say, and what anybody would say through the centuries, whether it's Homer or Shakespeare or Dostoevsky, that one is writing not about violence so much as the motives that lead into it, the complex psychological network that makes violence a part of life. And then also, very much in my case, I read about the aftermath of violence, the consequences for women and children who have been the victims of violence. It's not that I'm writing about violence per se or celebrating it, but I very often do write about the consequences.
You've written a little bit about violence in your own family. You had a short memoir piece in the New York Times a while back that told in part about how your father's grandfather tried to kill your father's grandmother and then shot himself instead. Is that a story that's had a kind of really big impact on your family?
Not really, so far as I know, because it never was told to me until I was an adult. I think I was in my 40s before I heard that.
Oh, so you were already a writer when you heard that.
Yes. Well, I think most family sagas that have anything a little bit sinister about them are not told. The children grow up without knowing them. The adults may make allusions to them, and there may be a kind of atmosphere of something repressed. But no, I didn't know about that. Then my mother's father was actually murdered, and she was given away. So I'm from a world in which violence had definite consequences for both my parents, really made their lives. It radically lessened the freedom and possibility of their lives.
Did you say your mother was given away?
Well, she was given away to relatives, but there were so many children in the family. I think there were 9, and she was just a baby. Well, they're very poor. I mean, we're talking about extremely poor people in a time where there wasn't public welfare assistance. I mean, we're really talking about a long time ago, like the early 20th century.
How old were you when you found out about that story?
That story, gee, I was probably well into my 30s. These things are not talked about very much, and since I did write about it, I suppose it's become public, but I do rather wince at it. Sometimes we write things in the solitude of a study. I was writing about my father, and this came out in my writing. You know, you sit alone in your study and you're writing out of some passion to tell the truth, and then years go by and suddenly what you've written has become really in the public domain, and it's still you can't quite believe it, that you ever really said that.
Yeah, tell me the difference about that feeling that it's your job as a writer to tell the truth, but the conflicting feeling in an interview that it's your job to kind of withhold the truth when it's personal.
Well, it's really a matter of finding the right language for it. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the essay on my father, I spent weeks on it, and I really worked it over and I calibrated all the language and had him read it, and I thought a lot about it, so it came out really like a kind of prose poetry. But when one is speaking spontaneously, one doesn't have that margin for, obviously, you know, for thinking and premeditating and so forth. So I think one feels much less in control. That if I could put certain truths in the right linguistic context, then they come out a little more truthful, in a matter of fact. But if one speaks sort of bluntly, it can come out of context and careen and veer along and seem almost untruthful.
And be misunderstood.
Be misunderstood.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joyce Carol Oates, and she's written a new novel called Foxfire. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Joyce Carol Oates is my guest. Were you writing as a teenager?
Yes, I've always been writing, really, as long as I can remember.
What were you writing about?
I suppose I was writing about being a teenager. I was probably writing about some of my own experiences and living out in the country. And I had the occasion of rereading a story of mine, my first published story that was in a high school literary magazine. Somebody is doing an anthology of the first published stories by American writers. And so he located the story for me and said, would you mind if I reprinted it? So I read it, and I had not seen it for 40 years, and I was really astounded by it. I didn't remember it very well.
Were you embarrassed, or did you feel proud?
As I said, I didn't remember it very well. I think I would have been quite astounded if a student of mine had written that story. It just seemed to have so much detail in it, and I was strangely impressed by it. I was almost a little amazed at it. I wouldn't have thought I could have written that well at that age, which would be about 16. I mean, it just did surprise me.
Well, good. a lot of us have the experience of going back and reading earlier stuff, and it's incredibly embarrassing.
Well, writers are always a little bit concerned, maybe all artists are a little bit concerned that what they've done in the past is comes out of a place in them that they don't have access to anymore.
Oh, and that they've lost something forever.
You've lost something forever. Certainly you've lost a sense of wonder and naivete. We tend to think that we gain in technique and control as we lose a sense of energy. I used to be able to write a short story all the way through as a first draft, say 25 pages, and then go back and rewrite it. Now I could never do that. I could never write 25 pages straight through.
You're still incredibly prolific.
But I don't have that kind of energy. I do a lot of revising. In fact, 90% of what I do is revision. Very careful. I type over and over again. I don't have a word processor. I just work over and over again, each paragraph, each page. But I do remember when I was much younger, I could just go through and write about 30 pages, be very exhausted. And then the next day, I would rewrite it. I would do the revision.
Why don't you use a computer?
I did have one for a couple of years. Well, as I say, I do so much revision that it's easier just to be on a typewriter so I can see it. I would have to be printing out constantly. I do most of my writing is done in longhand anyway, and then I transfer it to the typewriter. Mm-hmm. I don't think it really matters the way in which we write. It's more the way the mind is processing the language.
Were you the first person in your family to go to college?
I was the first person to graduate from high school.
Oh. What was that very significant in the family?
I suppose it was. I don't have any memory of it being. I've always been fairly modest about my own self, and I admire my parents enormously. They weren't able to go to high school and college because of the Depression. They had to work, and they had a very difficult life of a kind that people today probably don't know about. That is, my students, being born so much later in the 20th century, just don't have any knowledge at all of the Depression and how that changed people's lives. As I said earlier, Terry, it really represented a violent curtailing of the freedom and possibility of my parents' lives. I mean, they might have both gone to college. My father in particular has always been interested in music, and he might have done something in music, but that was never an option. He was working when he was 12 years old.
So but college got you away from home.
Very much, yes, but I've been very close to my parents. I'm still close to my parents.
The house that you grew up in, I think, doesn't exist anymore?
No, the house doesn't, but my parents have built a smaller house on the same land, the same plot of land.
Oh, so you still have a place to go home to that would recall the childhood memories?
Oh, absolutely. I was just there last week.
I didn't realize that the plot of land is still there, too.
My mother's lived on the same plot of land for about 75 years. The same land. That's that generation. It's a very different situation for most Americans today, where Americans are always in motion.
You have a sister who's autistic and has been institutionalized since her adolescence. I guess I'm wondering what it was like for you, as someone who lives so much in a world of language and writing, to have a sibling whose condition prevents them from communicating.
Oh, I've thought about it so much. I've written a little poem about it. I wanted to write more about it, but all that came out was a poem of about 12 lines. That's really all I could get into language. I think it's so hard to articulate our thoughts about certain subjects because we don't want to seem superficial or glib. We don't want to seem to be exploitative, certainly. So I haven't said much about it, really. I was 18 when my sister was born, and I was going away to college. She was born on my birthday, which is June 16th, and she actually looks very much like me. She's never uttered a coherent sentence. She's locked in this world of autism, which we know to be caused by some sort of biochemical imbalance in the brain. And medical technology is really experimenting and making good inroads into the problem. But my sister's autism is very extreme. It's not at all like the autism of Dustin Hoffman's movie Rain Man.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman was at the far end of autism, that is almost really almost normal. On a scale of 1 to 10, he would be 10, whereas my sister would be about 1 or 2.
Do you visit her? Do you see her?
No, I haven't seen her in a long time. She wouldn't know me. She wouldn't recognize anyone. She knows my parents, I think.
Do you remember the poem? Is it something you could, like, recite for us?
Well, I could possibly stumble through it, but I think I'd rather not. I think the final line is just something about, to know you, sister, is not my privilege. That I can't know her, no matter how I contemplate her and write about her and think about her. Ultimately, it's a mystery. It's just a profound mystery.
You started publishing in the 60s. As a woman writer then, was being a woman ever held against you or ever used as a way to discourage you from pursuing writing?
Oh, absolutely. There was no women's liberation at that time and really no consciousness of women being equal to men in any way. It was really felt that those of us who wrote about male subjects like politics or society and indeed crime and violence, that was really felt that I was transgressing or trespassing into some male domain.
Now, how was that told to you?
Well, I would see it in reviews. I remember one headline, which was the headline over a very negative review of a play of mine, and the headline was Detroit Housewife Writes a Play. And I, at that time, I was a professor at the University of Detroit. I was a professional woman with a job, and it happened that I was a married woman. But can you imagine today, Detroit housewife writes a play or writes a novel? The word housewife was used pejoratively, and the idea of the headline, which was in the Detroit News, I think, was that the audacity of a housewife to write a play or a novel, and that this is something that shouldn't be ridiculed. Then the review was very negative.
When did you first become aware of the women's movement?
I was involved with a friend of mine named Patricia Burnett, was a national officer in NOW, the National Organization of Women, when it was just being organized back in the 1970s. And Patricia Burnett was and is my friend. I knew her very well then. Since then, we haven't seen each other very much in years since I've left Detroit. But so I was involved very much.
How did it change you?
Oh, it's that's like Foxfire, where the girls get together and they realize that each one of them had seemed to be alone and seemed to be isolated. And her sense of inadequacy or her fears or her disappointments or terrors had seemed to be very idiosyncratic and individual, and then she gets together with other girls, as they do in Foxfire, and realizes that these are shared. So too with women in the 1970s, the 1960s and 1970s, that we saw ourselves mirrored in one another, and we could be encouraging to one another. And this always was a sense of elation, I think, and happiness. It wasn't that women got together to be very negative about men or to be critical of men. Not at all. The feeling that I got was one of energy, and it was energizing.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joyce Carol Oates' new novel is called Foxfire, Confessions of a Girl Gang. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the lives of homeless women. We talk with Elliot Lebo. When he found out he had cancer, he retired from his job and worked at a homeless shelter. His new book is a study of the women he met there. Lebo also wrote the 1967 classic Tally's Corner, a study of African-American street life still used by college students today. And rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Sons of Soul, the latest hip-hop album by Tony. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. NATO military officials are urgently planning for possible airstrikes against Serbs in Bosnia. Two courses of action are being considered, one to give air support to UN ground forces, the second a large-scale airstrike on specific Serbian targets. NPR's Martha Raddatz has that story.
Close to 60 attack aircraft from the United States, France, Britain, and the Netherlands are at bases in Italy awaiting the go-ahead. The U.S. also has attack jets aboard the USS Roosevelt, which is now in the Adriatic Sea. The only major element missing is forward air controllers on the ground to help coordinate strikes to protect the UN ground forces. They should be in Bosnia soon, according to the Pentagon's Captain Michael Doubleday.
The UN Secretary General is awaiting word from the UN PROFOR commander that all of his assets are in place before he gives the final go-ahead to that course of action.
As for an expanded airstrike, Doubleday would not comment other than to say plans are going ahead rapidly. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has confirmed the nomination of Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the U.S. Supreme Court by a vote of 96-3. She will be only the second woman to serve in the nation's highest court. She was confirmed in one of the easiest and quickest Senate proceedings on a Supreme Court nomination in recent years. Voting against confirmation were Senators Jesse Helms of North Carolina, Don Nichols of Oklahoma, and Bob Smith of New Hampshire. A court of appeals in Cincinnati has cleared the way for former Cleveland auto worker John Demjanjuk to return to the United States. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals told the United States Justice Department that it must not interfere with Demjanjuk's return to this country. A three-judge panel ruled that the former Ohio resident should be allowed to enter the U.S. as soon as he's freed in Israel. Currently, the Sixth Circuit Court is trying to determine if Demjanjuk's 1986 extradition was handled improperly. Last week, the Israeli Supreme Court overturned Demjanjuk's conviction and death sentence. That court said that there was not enough evidence to prove that Demjanjuk was the infamous Nazi death camp guard Ivan the Terrible. Sunday, an Israeli court ordered him to stay in that country until investigators decide whether he should be charged with other war crimes. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has approved the nomination of federal Judge Louis Freeh to head the FBI by a vote of 18-0. The full Senate is expected to give final approval to the nomination sometime this week. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,561.27 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton will speak to the nation less than one half hour from now about his deficit-cutting plan that he calls a good package. The speech to be carried on radio and TV is also aimed at a handful of Democratic senators that the White House needs in order to gain approval. The final plan, reached after a half year in negotiations, calls for deficit cuts over 5 years' time through higher taxes, mainly for upper-income taxpayers and corporations, and spending cuts and military interest in some domestic programs. The House is expected to vote on the plan Thursday and the Senate Friday. The president's primetime speech is expected to last about 20 minutes. The Army Corps of Engineers broke through a levee in Illinois today to save another one just below it, and it appears to have been a successful effort. Dave Cohen of member station KBIA reports.
Floodwaters raging across farmland had already broken through two levees and were approaching a third. So the Army Corps of Engineers used a crane on a barge in the Mississippi River to tear a hole in the levee, allowing water from another river to fill the area, acting as a speed bump to slow the oncoming rapids. The Army Corps of Engineers, Bob Anderson, says if they hadn't done this, they would have lost the next levee protecting Prairie du Rocher.
It would have pounded into the levee. It would have tried to force a way under it, and it probably would have forced its way over. And once a levee is over top, it isn't long until it becomes a breach.
So far, it's working. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Cohn in Jefferson City.
Germany's central bank has lowered a short-term interest rate as a move that it hopes will serve to stimulate the German economy. An official of the Bank of France said the drop in the German repurchase rate is a very positive sign. The rate lowers expenses for banks for borrowing money short-term. If these savings are passed on to corporate borrowers, it can lead to more investment. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It may be easier than you think to wind up homeless. Losing a job lands some people on the streets. Some jobs just don't pay enough to cover rent. Some homeless people are working but live on the streets or in shelters. These are some of the things Elliot Lebo learned during his study of homeless women at shelters in a town just outside Washington, D.C. His new book is called Just Tell Them Who I Am. You may recognize Lebo as the author of a 1967 book called Tally's Corner, a study of life on a street corner in an African-American neighborhood. The book is still in print and still used in many college courses. After it was published, Lebo went to work at the National Institute of Mental Health and didn't write another book until now. He started this study after he learned he had cancer and was told he didn't have long to live.
When I first learned about cancer, it was pretty advanced. It had already metastasized. This was 1984. And I was given to believe that I had anywhere from maybe 6 months to 18 months life expectancy. And I decided I really didn't want to spend those last months in a government office. So I retired on disability. I had a lot of time on my hands, and I felt pretty good at the time. So I started doing some volunteer work at a nearby soup kitchen. That was just one night a week, and I kind of liked that. So I decided to do the same thing, become a volunteer also one night a week at a shelter for homeless women. Over the next couple of weeks, I found myself so drawn to the women, so awed by them, and enjoying myself with them so much, that I started going there 4 and 5 times a week. And after a few weeks, I decided I'll take notes. It's one of the things I was trained to do and one of the things I knew how to do. And even though I had no idea of where it might end up, I thought it might be a good way to structure my day and my time, too.
Since you are a middle-class professional, it was, I'm sure, assumed by the women that you had some money. Did you feel responsible for them? And did you try to buy them meals and drive them around, and do you know what I mean? I'm sure you felt in a really awkward spot, like you had so much more than they did, yet it wasn't your responsibility to provide for them.
I'm not sure that I felt awkward. I was some, let's see, I think maybe embarrassed is more accurate. It was embarrassing to be middle class, to have the kind of income I had and the kind of home I had, and to see people with none of these things and watch them in this struggle, a titanic struggle, really, to stay human and to gain just those minimal decencies of life and creature comforts that the rest of us just take for granted. It was really, it was quite a sight to see. And it's also a little bit embarrassing to have so much when you're surrounded by other people who have so little.
Did they try to hit you up for anything?
Very few. I tried to, as a matter of fact, I was hoping that more of them would exploit me than they did.
And why exactly were you hoping that?
Well, I think, first of all, because of my own embarrassment, I would have felt better if I could have, if I was meeting more of their immediate needs without volunteering it myself. I didn't want this to be a donor-beggar relationship. I wanted our relationship to be one of, if I could manage it, to be one of mutual trust, to be close to friendship, as best as a middle-class man can be friends with a homeless woman. And I set up what I told them was a kind of revolving fund. and I routinely lent out $2, $5, $10, and sometimes $20 to the handful of people who would ask for it, and explained to them that I needed the money back, if only to keep that revolving fund going so I could lend it to other people.
Well, that's interesting. So you had set aside a certain amount of money, and it was up to them to replenish the kitty, right, so to speak.
Well, I said that I had set aside a certain amount. In fact, I hadn't. There was no fixed dollar limit.
Mm-hmm.
At any given time, I might have had as much as, I would say maybe at any given time, maybe $200 or $300 outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
To not many women, and many of them knew. Many of them knew that they could borrow money from me, but chose not to.
Hmm.
Maybe in the same way that many of them knew that they were eligible for one or another kind of welfare and chose not to take advantage of it.
How did you spend your days with the women when you weren't at the shelter? What did they do with their time? They didn't have to be anywhere.
Yeah, they sure didn't have to be anywhere. That was one of the great problems for many of the women, that they didn't have to be anywhere. It raised all kinds of existential questions for them. I remember one woman who put it quite eloquently. The worst time of day, she said, for her was 7 o'clock in the morning. I must explain that most of the shelters require all the women to be out on the street by 7 o'clock in the morning. You can't stay there after 7. The shelter remains closed until 7 o'clock that evening. So the women are on the street or on their jobs. Many of them work or job hunting or whatever it is they do. They're on the street in any event between 7 o'clock in the morning and 7 o'clock in the evening. And for one of the women, the moment that she stepped out of the shelter at 7 o'clock onto the street was the worst time of day, because that was the point at which she had to decide where to go and what to do and who to see. And it struck her repeatedly every day that she had no place to go, that nobody wanted her anywhere, that nobody expected her anywhere, that nobody cared what she did. And imagine facing that. I mean, that wasn't just an occasional thought. That was something that overwhelmed her, that sense of distance from the rest of the world, the sense of being surplus, the sense of being ignored, the sense of being alienated so totally and so completely, was a daily experience, every day at 7 o'clock.
So where would she go?
Well, she might go to a coffee shop and spend some, or there were some government buildings there. She would go to a government lunchroom maybe and have breakfast, which she had breakfast at the shelter if she wanted it, but she might go there for coffee and a donut, kill some time till the library opened. The library opened at 9. She might go to do a personal business. Being homeless is hard work, and you may have to go to social services. You may have to go to a doctor. You have to go job hunting. There are a lot of things that many of them do, and that's not enough. One of the most difficult things, really, for many of the women, was killing time. How do you get from 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening when the shelters open up?
My guest is anthropologist Elliot Lebo. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elliot Lebo, author of the new book, Tell Them Who I Am, The Lives of Homeless Women. You said that sometimes it was really remarkable to watch the women fix themselves up to go to work or to go hunt for a job.
Yes.
In the mornings.
Yes.
How would they do that?
It amazes me. One of the most surprising things was to see a woman get up in the morning and being homeless and transform herself into what looked like a very ordinary middle-class woman who's off to a middle-class professional job. Some of the women, say, were saleswomen in some of the better department stores even, or a data entry clerk for IBM. Now, you've got to make a fairly good presentation of yourself in order to get those jobs, in order to keep them. And to see these women organize themselves in such a way so that in the morning when they left the shelter, they would be presentable, not only for a very demanding boss, but for also a very demanding public in terms of the clientele of the establishment that she worked for. The women were doing some amazing things with a curling iron and some cosmetics, and with very few clothes, perhaps, but carefully using them, carefully matching and coordinating a skirt with a blouse in such a way that they were able to really make themselves indistinguishable from people who were, at least at the moment, much more successful than they had been.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you what might strike you as a strange question, but since you were a man, being the participant observer with a group of homeless women, did any women interpret your attentions as flirtatious?
Maybe so. I say maybe because a few times I was asked things like, if you weren't married, would you give me a run for my money? That was a difficult question to answer. Normally, I tried to avoid it. Avoid a direct answer because either yes or no would really be a misrepresentation. If I said yes to that question, I would give you a run for your money, I would probably not be telling the truth. If I said no, it would be a very hurtful thing to say and gratuitously hurtful, and there'd be no point in saying no to just hurt that other person for no reason whatever. And my usual response was a kind of avoidance response by saying, listen, I think you're very nice. I really do. I think you're a very nice person. And I usually meant it. Well, as a matter of fact, I meant it all the time when I said it. And that was usually enough. That seemed to satisfy them, and that question didn't come back again from the same woman.
You had explained you were doing a study?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They all knew I was doing the study. And they all knew why I was there.
Did the women know that you had cancer?
Yes. They did know, and that was an important part of my relationship with them. They knew when I had to go. I used to, at that time, in the first few years of hanging out there, I used to go to Canada, to Quebec, to get a drug that wasn't available here in the States. I used to go every 3 months, and the women all knew I made those trips. And it was an easy way for us to start a conversation. They could always start a conversation with me if they wanted to. In a very ordinary way, by asking me how I was feeling, or by asking me about the treatment, or asking me about the drugs, or life expectancy, or anything like that. And that, in turn, enabled me to ask them the same kinds of questions about their health concerns and about their health problems. So it was a very real part of... I didn't go out of my way to make a big deal of it, but it was a very real part of our relationship, because it was still another... focus... it was another issue that could become a focus of conversation and of a relationship.
And it meant that you weren't living this absolutely perfect life while they were living tragic ones. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I that is something that never got talked about, but I suspect that was true. It may well be that they felt more sorrow and pity for me than I felt embarrassment of my own riches.
Now that your book is finished, are you still going to the shelters?
I stopped. The shelter I spent most of my time at closes from April 1st to November 1st. I was not able to go there this past year. I've been having trouble, a little bit of trouble, side effects from drugs in managing some stairs, and that's three flights up. So I'm hoping to be able to return to the shelter when in November when it opens up. If not, maybe I'll find another shelter or soup kitchen to go to. But I feel very attached to this particular one. I identify with it so closely after having spent several years there in such an intimate way that I'd really like to go back to the same one.
How's your health?
Pretty good. Very good until I go... it's terrific until I go to the doctor or until I go to the clinic or something like that.
Well, because of what they tell you or...
The tests and the assessments that they do don't always correspond to how I feel. I usually feel an awful lot better than they're telling me I should feel.
Right. Well, they told you you should have been dead a few years ago, actually.
Well, yeah, and most of the discomforts that I experience are not directly from the from tumors or the cancer itself, but rather side effects of the chemotherapy or some other drugs. Mm-hmm. But I feel very good.
Did you find yourself becoming angry in the years that you did this study? Angry at conditions that cause homelessness?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm angry at the system. I'm angry at the system for 2, 3, 4 basic failures. I'm angry at the system for creating so many poor people. I'm angry at the system which allows people to work year-round full-time and not be able to support themselves and their dependents. I'm angry at a system which puts the blame for being poor on poor people themselves and says, how dare you be poor, and we're going to force you back into the workforce by making available very low welfare payments. We're going to shame you into going back. We're going to dare you to go back. We're going to push you to go back into the workforce. When many of these people, even when they work, they can't support themselves. We have a system which can't put its citizens to work. We have millions and millions of people out there job hunting. And we're talking about forcing women, let's say, on AFDC, forcing them into job market, too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Elliot Lebo is the author of Tell Them Who I Am, The Lives of Homeless Women. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have about Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. Martha Raddatz has the update on Clinton administration plans to liberate Sarajevo. And I'll be talking with a defense analyst about the possible usefulness and the possible dangers of airstrikes in Sarajevo. He says that ground troops would be needed to have any real effect there. Also, Linda Wertheimer talks with a Wisconsin floodplain expert about the future of the Mississippi Valley. His recommendation, it sounds simple, put up levees around the towns and let the floods come in to the farmland. And an economist makes this point, what is wrong with the federal deficit, arguing that the government needs to take a strong lead in spending.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tony is a trio consisting of brothers Dwayne and Raphael Wiggins and their cousin Timothy Riley. They've just released their third album, Sons of Soul. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's both a throwback to 60s and 70s rhythm and blues and an advance in hip-hop style.
Tell from that very pretty bit of music, Tony aren't kidding around when they call themselves Sons of Soul. That song, called Leavin', is the Tony's salute to falsetto soul men like Smokey Robinson and the Temptations' David Ruffin. At the same time, Leavin' features a rolling, tumbling beat that's more urgent, more contemporary than the music made by those veteran Motown acts. This collection leads off with the single If I Had No Loot, a song I'll bet Stevie Wonder wishes he'd written. Tony emerged from Oakland, California a few years ago as your not uncommon funky vocal act with uneven material and a vague collective personality. Since that time, they've emphasized playing their own, sometimes acoustic instruments and writing their own songs. On Sons of Soul, they come into focus as smart, considerate fellows who like to flirt, romance, and remember important dates, as is proven on this ballad, Anniversary. The neatest trick pulled off by the Tonys on this collection is that they invoke nostalgia without wallowing in it. Listening to them summon up styles ranging from Isaac Hayes to Sly Stone is like engaging in a friendly debate about the roots of soul music. And right now, it's the best argument around.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein, Nancy Greenlace, and Sue Spolin. All of us at Fresh Air welcome the listeners of Maine Public Radio, which started broadcasting Fresh Air this week. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The number of women with AIDS is growing. Many of them are single mothers. What will happen to their children? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Laura Jimenez. She has AIDS and is the mother of a 10-year-old son. And we'll talk with Kara Levine, executive director of the Orphan Project. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.